I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Today, a Democracy Now! Global exclusive. We're joined in studio by Columbia University student, Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi, in his first live interview since being released after more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison.
It feels good to be outside of prison, but the sense of freedom for me to be free is to actually, for all of us to be free, not only myself. So my freedom is interlinked with the freedom of other students who are still detained and interlinked with the freedom of the Palestinian people. But it feels good to be able to come to New York City and to be able to hike basically in the forests of Vermont.
Mohsen Mahdawi is here in New York for his graduation at Columbia. Then we look at the Republican push for sweeping cuts to Medicaid. By one count, over 14 million people could lose health coverage. Plus, the Supreme Court has just heard oral arguments about President Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. It's a case that could result in the justices scaling back the power of federal judges to issue nationwide injunctions. The court appears divided.
As far as I see it, this order violates four Supreme Court precedents.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's carried out its deadliest day of strikes across the Gaza Strip since it shattered a ceasefire in mid-March. Israeli attacks killed at least 143 people since dawn Thursday, according to health officials, bringing the documented death toll in Gaza to over 53,000, though thousands more are missing under the rubble and presumed dead. One in five Palestinians, some 500,000 people, are facing starvation, according to the United Nations, with Israel's total blockade of food, water and medicine now in its 74th day. In Khan Yunis, 13-year-old Palestinian Reem Aznati narrowly survived an Israeli strike that collapsed her family's home. After her father pulled her from the rubble, she learned that many of her relatives were dead.
The entire family of my uncle has been martyred. May they rest in peace. How would one feel to see all their loved ones come out as remains from under the rubble? My cousin's name is Mena. She's 1 year younger than me. She was just with me yesterday night. I swear, she bid farewell to me and told me goodbye, as if she felt it.
The head of the UN Children's Fund, Catherine Russell, condemned Israel's attacks, writing, quote, "It's unconscionable that over 45 children have reportedly been killed in airstrikes in Gaza in 2 days. This should shock the world, but is largely met with indifference. Nowhere is safe for children in Gaza," UNICEF's director said. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers raided the Palestinian town of Tamun Thursday, killing 5 men after laying siege to a home in the village center. One of the men apparently burned to death, according to Tamun's mayor. The deadly raid came after a pregnant Israeli from a nearby settlement was shot and killed. In response, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, called for nearby Palestinian towns to be flattened, just as Israel has destroyed cities in the Gaza Strip. On Capitol Hill, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib reintroduced a resolution Wednesday to recognize the Palestinian Nakba, or catastrophe, the Arabic word, on its 77th anniversary. The Nakba commemorates the murder, dispossession, forced displacement of Palestinians during the formation of Israel. Tlaib's resolution was co-sponsored by 8 other Congress members.
There are days that I feel so alone in this chamber as the only Palestinian American serving in Congress. The dehumanization and the anti-Palestinian racism here is painful, especially when my colleagues remain silent on the starvation of children and vote to send more bombs to the Israeli government while they commit war crimes with impunity.
President Trump has wrapped up his visit to the United Arab Emirates. After touting over $200 billion in investment deals with the Gulf nation on the last leg of his Middle East tour, the latest deals include Emirati investments in artificial intelligence, including the construction of a major AI data center in Abu Dhabi, which would import U.S.-made AI chips, likely from the company NVIDIA. Deals were also signed with Boeing and GE Aerospace. During his visit, Trump also referenced a promised $1.4 trillion investment from the UAE that he'd first announced in March. Meanwhile, Democratic lawmakers in both the House and Senate issued resolutions of disapproval over $3.5 billion in weapons sales to the UAE and Qatar. The lawmakers cited conflict of interest concerns related to Trump's cryptocurrency ventures, as well as the UAE's support of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces. As he prepared to depart the UAE, President Trump said the U.S. has sent a proposal to Iran over a new nuclear deal after multiple rounds of talks between the two countries. Details of the plan remain unknown, and Tehran has refused U.S. demands to give up its uranium enrichment program. Earlier this week, Iran's president condemned Trump's what he called bullying after the U.S. president accused Iran of sponsoring terror and fighting bloody proxy wars. This is the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian.
When he says we have missiles and bombs that are unimaginable, are we causing a bloody war, or are you the ones who came to give bombs and missiles to the countries of the region? Who wants countries to fight each other by giving these weapons, bombs, and missiles, and then claims that we are peace-loving, we want peace to be implemented in society? Did we destroy 60,000 women and children in Gaza in a year under the bombs and missiles they had? Did we cut off their access to food, water, and medicine? Are we a danger?
In Turkey, negotiators from Ukraine and Russia are meeting today for the first direct peace talks since shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. But expectations of major progress remain low after delays and uncertainty over whether the meeting would actually happen and after Russian President Vladimir Putin refused to attend in person. On Thursday, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Ukraine's foreign minister met with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Also Thursday, President Trump asserted, quote, nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together, he said. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments Thursday in a case stemming from Trump's now-halted order to end birthright citizenship, which is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. The Trump administration's challenging whether federal judges can issue universal or nationwide injunctions against his orders. The case is raising alarms. The far-right-dominated Supreme Court could hand even more power to the executive branch as Trump seeks to overcome court injunctions against his many executive orders. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime from the standpoint of the executive, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
The Department of Homeland Security has asked the Pentagon to assign some 20,000 National Guard personnel to assist with Trump's mass deportation efforts. It's not clear whether Trump would seek to federalize the National Guard, something last done to respond to the 1992 uprising in Los Angeles that followed the police beating of Rodney King. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baraka appeared in federal court Thursday over his trespassing case following his arrest last Friday outside the Delaney Hall Immigration Jail, where he was meeting with 3 congressional Democrats. Alina Habba, who is the interim U.S. attorney for New Jersey and Donald Trump's personal lawyer, faced boos from the crowd of Baraka supporters as she showed up for the brief procedural hearing. Mayor Baraka said he had to resubmit to a mugshot and give fingerprints again Thursday as part of an attempt to humiliate him. Baraka's trial is expected to take place in mid-July, a month after primary elections in New Jersey, in which he's running for governor. Mayor Baraka spoke to journalists and supporters after his hearing.
The Constitution of the United States. Which gives everybody due process. No matter who you are, no matter what language you speak, no matter where your background is, what your gender is, or who you decide to love. That the Constitution protects everybody. Once you step foot on this soil, once you reside in this country, whether you document it or not, the Constitution protects you.
New York University, NYU, has come under fire for withholding the diploma of a student who used his commencement address to condemn genocide in Gaza. This is Logan Rosas delivering that speech on Wednesday.
The only thing that is appropriate to say in this time and to a group this large is a recognition of the atrocities currently happening in Palestine. The genocide currently occurring is supported politically and militarily by the United States, is paid for by our tax dollars, and has been live streamed to our phones for the past 18 months.
Logan Rosas received cheers and standing ovations from the crowd of peers and has been widely commended for his bravery. This comes as students at Yale, Stanford, UCLA, and the California State University system are continuing their hunger strikes to demand their schools divest from Israel and protect free speech on campus. Students have reported deteriorating health as school administrators continue to rebuff requests to meet. In related news, a new study finds more than 1,000 students across the U.S. were targeted, many of them penalized over their speech between 2020 and 2024. In Georgia, a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead has been kept on life support for 3 months against the wishes of her distraught family because of the state's abortion ban. Adriana Smith, a 30-year-old mother and nurse, has been legally dead since February following a medical emergency. But doctors have kept her on breathing machines because her fetus, just 9 weeks old at the time of Smith's medical emergency, was old enough to have detectable cardiac activity. Adriana Smith's mother said, quote, "It's torture for me. I see my daughter breathing, but she's not there," unquote. And some 450 New Jersey transit engineers walked off the job early this morning, grinding services to a halt on the country's third largest commuter rail system. It's New Jersey's first statewide transit strike in over four decades. The president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen said, quote, "They have money for penthouse views and pet projects, but not for their frontline workers. Enough is enough," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. Columbia University student, Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi joins us in his first live interview since being released after more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison. Stay with us.
We've always been all right. There ain't no golden days. We've always been all right. And kulushi tamam, kulushi tamam, kulushi tamam. We're all gonna be all right. And kulushi tamam.
Sanane performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Global exclusive. We're joined by Mohsen Mahdawi in his first live interview since being released after spending more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison. Mahdawi is a Columbia University student, Palestinian activist who holds a green card. He's a legal permanent resident. He was arrested in Vermont in mid-April when he appeared for what he'd been told was his naturalization interview. After completing the interview, he ended up being taken away by armed and masked federal agents. Mohsen moved to Vermont from the occupied West Bank in 2014, where he was third generation in his family, to live in El Farah, a Palestinian refugee camp. He later attended Lehigh University in Pennsylvania before transferring to Columbia in 2021 to study international affairs. At Columbia, he was co-president of Columbia's Palestinian Students Union and served as president of Columbia University's Buddhist Association for 2 years. Mohsen Mahdawi is one of several students who've been detained by the Trump administration. Former Columbia student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil has been detained since March 8th. Tufts PhD Fulbright scholar Ramesa Ozturk was released a week ago after 6 weeks in detention. And Georgetown University scholar Badr Khansouri was freed on Wednesday after nearly 2 months in detention. Mohsen Mahdawi spent 2 weeks in a Vermont prison before a federal judge in Vermont ordered him released on bail. The judge, Jeffrey Crawford, compared the recent detentions of immigrant student protesters to the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids of 1919-20. This is Mohsen Mahdawi speaking to supporters just after his release, April 30th.
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Judge Crawford ruled Mahdawi should stay in Vermont but could come to New York for educational purposes. When the government objected, the judge responded Mohsen Mahdawi could travel to New York to attend his graduation at Columbia. The judge went on to write, quote, during his time in New York State, Mr. Mahdawi is permitted to move freely and conduct his daily activities normally, including but not limited to meeting with elected officials, speaking with and being interviewed by members of the press and media, speaking at public events, attending protests, the judge wrote. Mohsen Mahdawi hopes to begin graduate studies in September at Columbia's SIPA. That's the School of International and Public Affairs. But the Trump administration is still trying to deport him. Well, Mohsen Mahdawi joins me here now in our New York studio for his first live interview. Welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your freedom, Mohsen.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be with you. And good morning to your audience as well.
So if you can start off by telling us what happened, why you ended up going back to Vermont for this final, what you thought, immigration interview. What happened?
I mean, I was waiting for this interview, which is my naturalization process to receive a citizenship for over a year. And the reason I had to go to Vermont because my residence, my permanent residence, is in Vermont. Therefore, I went to basically what I thought should be naturalization interview. I expected at the same time that there might be a trap set up for me, just seeing and witnessing what happened to other students, including Mahmoud Khalil and Rumeysa Ozturk. And therefore, I was prepared for that interview, that I might come on the other side with full rights or no rights.
We interviewed Vermont Congressmember Becca Ballant at the time because you had written to her. She's the sole congressmember in Vermont, as well as to Senators Peter Welch, who visited you in prison, and Senator Bernie Sanders. You wrote them all because you were so concerned about what would happen?
This is exactly right. I mean, I prepared for many different, on many different levels. Part of why I stayed in Vermont is because of the support that I received from official representatives, such as the senators and the congresswoman, who I'm very grateful for. But at the same time, also, I had to arrange with my lawyers in order to have everything drafted, ready to go, just prepared for the worst case scenario. So I prepared with the lawyers, contacted my representatives, and contacted my community members who are very close to me. And we saw the aftermath of this is I was able to stay in Vermont, something that other students did not have the luxury to do. They were uprooted from their communities and from legal support.
So what happened? You go to the naturalization interview. What day was that?
It was on the 14th of April.
And you went with your lawyer?
I went with one of my lawyers, an immigration lawyer. We go into USCIS office. This is the immigration office where I'm supposed to have my interview. And everything looked kind of normal. There were some signs. The officer who interviewed me inside was waiting for us. And after being in the lobby for a few minutes, the lobby was emptied from any other applicants. So it was only myself, my lawyer, and my friend. And they looked at them and they said, this is the calm before the storm.
And so you had your interview? Did you sign any documents?
Yes. I went through my regular interview for citizenship to the point I thought that I am going to receive the citizenship that same day, because I was asked the questions that I had to answer. I answered the questions correctly. And then I was asked if I am willing to take the Pledge of Allegiance. When the officer asked me if I am willing to do so, I said, of course. And he asked me to sign a document saying that I am willing to actually protect and defend the Constitution of this country. And shortly after that moment, just within a minute, the DHS agents storm the office, separate me from my lawyer, and they say that I am under arrest.
Masked?
I mean,
were they masked?
They were masked. They had hoods on. You could not recognize them, and they had guns on them as well.
And they masked around you? Did they handcuff you?
Yes, directly. Actually, there was not any space or room to show us documents or to explain anything. And they said, you're under arrest. So I gave them my hands and I said, I am a peaceful man. I am not going to resist.
And so you were taken. Where was your lawyer?
They prevented my lawyer from being with me. So I was taken through the back door into the lobby outside of that building into an unmarked SUV. And my lawyer did not know what's happening with me. In fact, at that time, all of what was going in their head is to basically execute the premeditated plan that they had in mind, which is to ship me, to send me to Louisiana. They had the tickets, the airplane tickets printed and ready. The agents had the tickets ready.
So they drove you to Burlington?
Well,
the airport?
Yes. So before they took me to the airport, they took me to a building to process me. And the processing, which we expected to take place in St. Albans at the prison, did not actually take place there. So I was surprised, very surprised. They processed me in a different building, separate building, only 10 minutes away from the airport. And then they drive me to the airport and they hand me to two other agents who are supposed to fly me on a commercial flight.
And what happened?
At that moment, I asked the agents, I said, are we going to Louisiana? And they said, yes. And I asked which direction. So I clarified that it's going to stop by New York City, then to Louisiana. We went into the airport and we realized that the flight was basically we were late. The flight was about to take off. The airplane was being taxied. During that time, I also was not feeling well. So I had to use the restroom for a brief time. And the moment I get out of the restroom, while we're walking towards the gate, we see the airplane being taxied away.
So your stop in the bathroom saved you from this plane?
I don't know if that is the reason, but some people think that this might be the reason.
When you got to the airport, you saw the plane pulling. When you got to the gate, you saw the plane pulling away?
Yes.
And what did that allow time for your lawyer?
I mean, if you think of it, that has changed the path of my legal fight for justice. It allowed my lawyers to fight on fair ground and to free me within 16 days, something that other students, as you saw, weeks and months they've been in detention.
So you were held in detention in a prison in Vermont?
Correct.
With other migrants?
That's right. In this prison, in fact, basically ICE rents a section of the prison. And the section where I was, it was a mixture of three quarters of people who have committed the crimes before and one quarter of migrants who come in and out. And I was, my cell was C38, the first cell in that C section where the migrants are. So I saw waves of the migrants. Those are not just migrants. Those are the people who feed us, who plant our food, who harvest our organic, delicious Vermont produce.
Like the dairy workers.
And the dairy workers as well. So I was able to meet the first wave, which is farm workers who, you know, worked on farms, and the second wave was farm workers who worked on the dairy, in dairy farms.
Describe the conditions of your detention and what that brought to you, what that reminded you of.
Fabric is of injustice. You see them everywhere. I was prepared for worst case scenario. So to be honest with you, being in this prison was not as bad as I thought mentally. But the difficult part was realizing this interconnectedness between injustices. It reminded me of my uncles, and specifically my uncle Abed. At some point when a guard shined the light through the squared window in the door, and the light was so strong in my eyes, and they remembered my uncle who had bloody eyes permanently. And then I thought...
Where was your uncle?
My uncle was imprisoned in the Israeli prisons, and now he's no longer alive.
He was
he
in the West
passed away
Bank.
2 years ago. That's correct. He was born, raised, and died in a refugee camp, the same refugee camp where I was born.
Al-Fara.
Yeah, yeah. And I had this realization when I was there. I am now interconnected to three generations of my family. My grandfather, who was unjustly imprisoned, my father and my uncles, who were unjustly imprisoned, and my cousins, who were also unjustly imprisoned. And now I can feel their pain.
You also lost your brother, as well as other members of your family. Talk about where you were born. Talk about your family in the West Bank and in Gaza.
What I am doing here in America, this is exactly the question that I hope for the government to ask and to look into, rather than just labeling me. What I've been protesting for is related to my firsthand life experience. As a child, I buried my own brother when I was 8 years old. He was 6 years old, and my brother faced serious issues. He was paralyzed because the Israeli army prevented my father from taking him to receive medical care. The camp was under siege. And then in the second Intifada, when it started in 2000, I was 10 years old. And I witnessed my best friend getting shot and killed in front of my eyes. And the pain of injustice that you feel when you see just a kid who you loved so much, his life being taken away in a second, is a painful experience. But that wasn't it, too. My uncle, on September 12, 2001, after September 11, my uncle Thayer was killed on the hands of the Israeli army as well.
Where?
In Tammun, in fact, between Al-Fara refugee camp and Tammun. The same town that five people were killed, it's only 5 miles away, actually 5 kilometers away, about 3 miles away from the refugee camp.
The five people were just killed.
That's
in the
correct.
Last day.
So it hits home. Everything that I am seeing and I am witnessing, I mean, in the second intifada also, I lost 2 cousins. I was shot in my leg when I was 15 years old. And some people would say, oh, what was happening and why those people were killed? This does not, what matters is that children live in pain, in suffering, in trauma. And we have to see that for what it is. And we cannot just